Good morning, all. For review for those who were here last night, and just a little catch up for those who weren't able to be here last night, we talked about the great symbiosis. The great symbiosis is the idea that the gods in the ancient world were believed to have created people in order to be slave labor for them. And so people met the needs of the gods, and the gods in turn met the needs of people so that people can continue to meet the needs of the gods. So it was that codependent relationship, which was the typical way of thinking about the gods in the ancient world and how people thought about themselves. Again, there's none of the dignity of being in the image of God. There's only the reason for existence of providing needs for the gods, a very different view of humanity and the role that they played. And so that's the great symbiosis, and that's what God was drawing the Israelites out of that way of thinking, out of that world, so that they could think differently about the relationship to God. And so that's how that was all set up. And so we talked about that. So when I use the term great symbiosis today, you'll have an idea of that. That's what's involved. And then, of course, we talked about the first four of the Ten Commandments and talked about how reading them in the context of the ancient world gave us a little bit different view of them and the ideas of what they were conveying and how they would be understood in the ancient world. We pointed out that they're called the Ten Words, not commandments, and that they're therefore helping people to understand the nature of things, rather than just duties that they have to perform. They're trying to understand how things really work in the world and how God works both in the heavens and on the earth and how they are supposed to respond on earth. So those are some of the things that we covered last night. In our sessions today, in this first session, I want to talk about really what is Deuteronomy? How does it work? What is it? What are its mechanics? So a little bit about the biblical book and how that operates. In the second session this morning, I'll be talking about law in the ancient Near East, because as we try to understand Deuteronomy as having law in it, and we're going to move away from that kind of paradigm, we do want to understand the backdrop of it. And then finally this afternoon, we'll be talking about the law today. What do we do with a book like Deuteronomy and all of its legal sayings today? And how does that provide us with a revolutionary perspective today? Last night we talked about the revolutionary perspective in the ancient world. And so we'll end up by talking about the revolutionary nature of Deuteronomy for today. So that's how the sessions are laid out. Who knows, as I flow along, I may rearrange things as I go just to try to make it work well. So let's start out. Again, we'll be getting to PowerPoint eventually, but we won't start out with it this morning. So what is the book of Deuteronomy? Deuteronomy is a series of sermons by Moses. It contains an elaboration of the 10 words, let's call them the Decalogue, which of course means 10 words. So the elaboration of the Decalogue. But the main thing that we often think about when we read the book of Deuteronomy is law, legislation, which in fact it is not. It's possible, certainly, matter of fact, it's likely, that it contains some of the legislation that would have been part of ancient Israel's society. But it is not here in this book and in the Bible as legislation. It's in the Bible as a covenant document between God and his people. It contains stipulations, and those stipulations are the things that strike us as law. But see, one of the difficulties is that as we read the text of Deuteronomy, we say, well, this is not really our law. We're not in that society, and that's not how this works for us. So what is it? And sometimes people get the idea that, well, it should be our law. But no, it's not given as legislation. for all people of all time, this is the legislation that you should live under. It's rather framed as a covenant document. Now, how does a covenant document work? Someone mentioned last night they had not yet heard the word treaty. Now you'll hear it. Okay? Deuteronomy follows the basic format that international treaties followed in the ancient world. We have a series of international treaties between the Hittites and a variety of other countries from about the time period of Moses, the middle of the second millennium BC. So we have a number of those international documents. We can see the form that they take and how they operate, the rhetoric that they have, and the various structures that they show. And so we can compare those treaty documents to what we find in the book of Deuteronomy. Besides the ones from the Hittites in the middle of the second millennium, we have a series of treaties from the Assyrians in the middle of the first century. And not a whole lot has changed between over that 1,000 years between the Hittites and the Assyrians. There are some changes in terms of what kind of emphasis they give to one part or another, maybe a little bit of order changing around. But in the end, it's basically the same kinds of things. That doesn't matter so much for our discussion today, which you may be very glad to hear. We're not going to do a detailed study of the structure and, yeah, okay. But the idea of what kind of document would this be perceived to be by the ancient readers? That's what this gives us. This shows us that with the structure that Deuteronomy has, people in the time of Moses would have understood that this is the kind of document that sets up relationships between major groups. Again, usually between nations. So the Hittites and the Aramaeans or something of that sort. But here, it's a little bit different. Because instead of being between nations, it's between God and a chosen people. So the two parties are still a nation is one of them, the nation of Israel, but the other party is God. That is unusual. As a matter of fact, we don't know anything else like that in the ancient world. There's never a case where a God is making some kind of treaty agreement, covenant agreement, with people. Certainly there are peoples in the ancient world that believed that their gods showed special favor to them, that they had elected them in a sense. They don't use that language really, but that they favored them in special ways. And so the Assyrians, for instance, would have said that their gods had shown favor to them and were leading them to conquests in their imperialistic endeavors around the ancient world. And so they believed that the gods had shown favor to them and were bringing them prosperity. But that's not the same thing as what we find in God's relationship to Israel. The covenant relationship that's laid out in Deuteronomy is not just the idea that God has found favor with them. In fact, we're shown all kinds of instances where God is quite angry with them and when they're not doing what they're supposed to do and God is disappointed in their behavior and all of these things. It's not the language of the gods love us kind of thing. It's really much more realistic in terms of the vacillation of that relationship between God and his people. But the idea that God would make a covenant treaty type of agreement with people is something that you just don't find in the rest of the ancient world. Now, we can understand that, given what we talked about last night, we can understand that you wouldn't find that in the rest of the ancient world, because covenants and treaties are about relationship. And as we mentioned last night, there really is not the concept of a relationship between God and people in the ancient world, other than sort of an ad hoc kind of, for the time being, things are working out. So this idea that there would be a relationship and that relationship would have the elements of both potential for blessing and potential for curse, that the relationship would last even though there were times when the people would be out of favor. Sometimes theologians today will talk about the covenant being conditional or unconditional. So is it conditional? Is it unconditional? Yes. It's both. That is, there are conditional aspects to the covenant, as we can see in the blessings and curses. If they do well, then God's favor will be on them. If they don't, well, then God's curses will come upon them. Those curses involve the benefits, or, of course, the other side of it, the troubles that they're going to have. So what Israel stands to gain as a people is conditional, based on their cooperation and getting with the program. But the covenant agreement as a whole is not conditional. That is, God has made a relationship with his people, and that's not going to change. They may benefit from it at times, they may really find it painful at times, but it's not going to change that God has this arrangement with his people. Now, I'm going to explain how that's the case. See, some people feel that, well, but when the church comes along, when Christ comes along, doesn't that covenant come to an end? How does that all work? We're going to talk about that next, as soon as we're ready to move into that. So, what we have in Deuteronomy, you should not think of as legislation. We'll come to understand it as legal material as we move along through the day. But it's a treaty relationship, a covenant made between God and his people. And again, that's another one of these revolutionary ideas in the ancient world, because God desires relationship with his people. Now, if we talked about the themes of Deuteronomy, it's pretty straightforward. One God, one people, one covenant, one sanctuary. There it is. One God. Okay, and so the whole idea we talked about last night, how Israel was interacting with one God, not a whole divine council, not a whole array of cosmic deities, but with one God. And that was very hard for them to grasp. The one God idea, of course, is commonplace today, even in other religions besides Christianity. But the one God idea in the ancient world was tried a couple times and failed miserably, except in Israel. The Egyptian king Akhenaten tried a one God system, not totally like monotheism, but moving that direction, and it failed miserably. And there's a possibility that at some point in Babylonian history that they gave that a shot, but that didn't work so well either. In the ancient world, that was just not the way that they thought. So with Israel, this was a revolutionary idea. There's one God. And he's a God who's not in the cosmos. He's outside the cosmos, but ruling the cosmos. So a different placement. You know, if you took all of the gods of the ancient world, take the Babylonians, for instance, take all of the thousands of gods that the Babylonians had and mushed them all together into one God and said, okay, now that's the same as Israel. No, it's not. Okay, because it's not just a matter of the number of the deities. It's a matter of how deity fits into the world and what deity is like. And that's what makes the difference. It's not just a matter of numbers. The numbers were, in a sense, inevitable, given the ancient worldview. But it's not just a matter of numbers. It's where God fits into the system and how that God works. I mean, that's really the same kind of conversation we might have with Muslims today. That is, you can say, well, we worship one God, we call him Allah, and we as Christians worship God. And, you know, but it's really just the same. Now, wait a minute. Let's talk about the attributes of that God. You know, that it's not just a matter of numbers. It makes a difference what that God is like. So that's one of the issues in the ancient. So it's one God, one people. God has chosen one people for himself, and that is the Israelites. Now, he didn't choose them because they had gained or earned his favor. Matter of fact, more of the Bible talks about how they have not earned his favor, how they kind of messed it up over and over again. So God didn't choose them because they had earned his favor. God did not choose Abraham because Abraham had earned his favor. Remember, Abraham was a pagan like everybody else when God came to him. So it wasn't because of something that was earned that this was the sovereign choice of God. and he chose this one people. Now, some people might say, well, why do they get to be the special ones? You know, that God picked them. Well, they didn't always see it that way. I mean, yes, they delighted in their identity as God's chosen people. But they also, more often than not, saw the downside of that. They saw the raw end of it because their expectations, the expectations God had of them, were higher because of the revelation they received. You know, Job at one point, in chapter 7, he has this moment where he echoes what we also read in Psalm 8, which Job probably didn't know, but that's all right. But he echoes what we read in Psalm 8. Psalm 8 says, what is man that you are mindful of him? This is a wonderful thing that you pay attention to us. And Job says, who am I that you're paying so much attention to me? You know, don't you have other things to do? Pay attention to somebody else for a change. You know, I'm getting tired of it. I can't even, you know, spit, and you're right on top of it. So there's the downside to God's attention. And I think Israel often felt that downside, even though they gloried in the fact that God had chosen them. So we shouldn't say, well, how come they get to be special? Well, that's God's choice. And again, they didn't always see it that way, as being singled out for wonderful things, because lots of times there is an edge to it. But God chose to work through them to affect others. So that's the idea. The election of Israel was not for their own account, just because I like you. The election of Israel was to be an instrument for God to reach out to everyone else through them. They were a channel. They weren't expected to be the end result, that it's all about Israel. It's all about everybody. It's all about humanity. But Israel was going to be the channel that God worked through. So, one God, one people. Thirdly, one covenant. We're going to talk about the covenant in a moment. Sometimes we talk about lots of different covenants, Abraham's covenant and David's covenant and the new covenant, and we'll pull all of that together, and so we'll talk about that in a moment. So one covenant, again, God didn't make covenants with lots of different people, and that has to do with the nature of what the covenant is doing. And then finally, one sanctuary. The idea that God was to be worshipped in one sanctuary. In Deuteronomy chapter 12 particularly has that element laid out. See, remember how the great symbiosis worked that we talked about last night. The gods have needs. And worship was carried out by actions that met the needs of the gods. Okay, that's how it worked. So your worship was to bring your rituals, your sacrifices, your libations. Your worship was involved in giving praise to the god. And so all of this was part of the ways in which people worshiped. That means that your worship, the worship for any particular deity, was given by people who lived in the vicinity of the temple. Because you had to bring your sacrifices, your gifts, to the temple. And people who lived 100 miles away aren't going to make that trip, at least not often. So in that sense, worship in the ancient world was local, because it had to be connected to the temple, because that's where the worship, the rituals to take care of the needs of the gods, took place. As a result, they had lots of temples. You wouldn't just have a temple to the god Marduk in Babylon, where his chief city was. You'd have temples to Marduk all over the place, because Marduk's going to have his needs met by all of these different people in all kinds of different towns with their little local temples. That's how the needs of the gods would be met, and that's what worship was. So the needs-based system, the great symbiosis, by definition, had to feature many temples. So when God tells Israel, there's just going to be one temple. I'm going to choose a place to put my name. Deuteronomy doesn't say it's Jerusalem. That develops later on. Okay, but I'm going to choose a place and put my name there, my name, his presence. Okay, and he can do that because he doesn't have needs that need to be met through the worship and the rituals in the temple. The rituals are for a different reason than for meeting the needs of the gods. So again, the whole ritual system takes on a different turn to it. Now, I promised I'd talk a little bit about the sacrificial system, and now's a good place as any to do it. How are the sacrifices of Israel different from the sacrificial systems in the rest of the ancient world? On the surface, you'd hardly know the difference if you just stood there and watched the performance of those rituals and the priests in the temple and the altars, you'd hardly notice any difference. We have plenty of information from the ancient world about their rituals, about the names of their sacrifices and their categories and all of these things. We can talk about what kinds of things were offered on the altars. And by the way, there's much less animal slaughter in the other religions. They still have it, but it's much less. That's because in Israel, there are blood rituals connected to the sacrifice. There are not blood rituals in the rest of the ancient Near East. They're still slaughtering animals, but more often they're offering food that they grow, because they're just thinking about feeding the gods. But the blood rituals are uniquely connected to Israel. Now, some of the others will occasionally use blood. They'll dab it on an animal and chase it away, like in the Day of Atonement for Israel. But the use of the blood in the rituals for Israel is something that you don't really find in the rest of the ancient world. So that's one thing that would look different. There would be more animal slaughter and the blood rituals that would look different. But we have to talk about what the sacrificial system does. Now, when you read through Leviticus chapters 1 through 7 or so, you'll get a list of all of the different sacrifices, and it's mind-boggling. You know, we read in Leviticus, we're just, I don't get it. You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. I'm not doing this stuff. Anyway, but we see there's different categories. The ones we are most familiar with are the ones called the sin offering and the guilt offering. Those are the main blood rituals that deal with the offense of people. The translations of both of those are questionable and probably wrong. Sin offering, guilt offering. But it's tough to change at this point. That's just become the vocabulary that we use. But let me describe a little bit about what those offerings do, because those offerings do not have strong parallels in the rest of the ancient world. The other offerings that Israel does, like the thank offerings and the vow offerings and those kinds of things, the free will offerings, those offerings are what you find in the rest of the ancient world. And again, in the rest of the ancient world, they're food for the gods. In Israel, they're just thank yous. They're gifts to God to thank him for what he's doing. And it's not a matter that God needs this for food. But it's the guilt and sin offerings that are different. And again, they're the ones that kind of dominate, because they're the ones that kind of eventually cross over into our understanding of Christ and his work. These sacrifices were meant to deal with two particular issues. The sin offering deals with the problem of when some sort of desecration or uncleanness or corruption intrudes on sacred space. The guilt offering is when something that is sacred is taken out and used for non-sacred use. So the sin offering is for bad things going in. The guilt offering is for good things coming out. Okay, moving different directions. Both of them involved blood, and both of them, a blood ritual, and both of them had the situation that no one was to partake of any of the meat of the animal. Lots of animal sacrifices became communal meals. But these, that was not the case. What's happening here is that Israel is showing a heightened awareness of the need to preserve the sanctity of sacred space. You don't let uncleanness in there. Because if you let uncleanness in there, God will not tolerate it and he will leave, which of course eventually happens in the exile. God leaves the temple, abandons it. Now you occasionally have examples of temple abandonment in the rest of the ancient world. where they'll talk about the idea that, a god abandoned the temples and the town was destroyed. But there, they ask, why did the gods abandon the temple? Oh, it was just time to move on. You know, just nothing at all. But now the idea that God's presence is not something that's for his benefit. See, the rest of the ancient world, the gods needed those temples. They wanted those temples. That's where they're taken care of. That's their luxurious living space. Okay? So the gods needed those temples. So they're not likely to abandon them easily. But for Israel, God doesn't need that temple. The temple provides a place for God's residence among his people so that he can be in relationship with them. Remember, it's all about relationship. And therefore, if Israel is going to maintain their side of that relationship, they have to keep sacred space clean. Now, let me make sure you're picking up the implication of that. That sin offering and that guilt offering was not about the individual's personal state of sinlessness or forgiven, anything of that sort. The sin offering and the guilt offering are about sacred space, not about people. It's what people do to sacred space that has to be remedied. Remember, Hebrews tells us clearly, the blood of bulls and goats can never take away sin. The Israelites are offering the blood of bulls and goats, not to take away their sin. It couldn't do that. They are offering the blood and bulls of goats to cleanse the sanctuary. The blood rituals are like an antiseptic, a disinfectant in a ritual sense. That is, when you sinned as an individual or as a group of people, the idea was that sin, being so close to God's presence, was drawn to God's presence. It's like you're throwing mud balls against the sanctuary walls. You're desecrating it with your sin. And when you do that, you are bringing jeopardy to the whole nation. Because if your sin is so great, or it builds up so much, it will cause God to leave. And everyone loses the benefit of God's presence among them. So the blood sacrifices of the sin offering and the guilt offering were meant to cleanse the sanctuary of the results of your sin. Your sin brought desecration. This is to cleanse away the sanctuary so that the relationship would be retained. Now, when those sacrifices are offered, it does say, okay, they're going to take the blood and they're going to spread it on something. The horns of the altar, the veil, depending on the sacrifice. The blood ritual, blood is applied, again, as a disinfecting agent. Okay, so the blood is applied to wipe it clean. Then it says, and your sin will be forgiven. That's not the same as your sin has been taken away. Only the blood of Christ took away sin. Your sin has been forgiven. Forgiveness here is a relationship term. It's not a judgmental term. Okay? Their sin had not been paid for. But they were forgiven because they had done what God asked of them. They've addressed the sin issue with regard to sacred space. And therefore, he was willing to say, our relationship is good. Forgiveness is a relationship term. Okay, so that's what's going on there. So those sacrifices, while they have a lot of the same look as in the ancient world, have a totally different kind of function. Again, a revolutionary idea that we should conceive of this whole concept of God's presence in the midst of his people differently. Even though it looks the same, there's a temple and God is in it, it's God's place, da-da-da-da-da, same as the rest of the ancient world, but so different. He's there so he can be in relationship. And that relationship demands attention, constant attention. Okay, and remember the sins for which Israel would be bringing those offerings, they're not at all the same kinds of sins that would have been considered in the ancient world. The only offense in the ancient world is not bringing an offering. Right? Because the whole idea was that you're meeting the needs of the gods. If you withhold your offerings, then, you know, you're offending the god. But here there's a totally different reason involved. Now, it's true, in the ancient world they might think, well, the god might be angry with me because I walked on sacred space and I didn't even know it was sacred, and I offended the god. See, it's that kind of imagination. Remember, gods in the ancient world had not revealed themselves, and so people didn't know what they might have done to offend the gods. The worst thing you could do is withhold a sacrifice. But see, now Israel's thinking about there are things that we do, again, breaking the covenant, being unfaithful, things that we do that bring desecration to God's presence, and we need to deal with that with these blood rituals. So that's one of the, that's kind of how to think about these sacrifices as different. It got the Israelites thinking about sin, an offense against God, in ways that are very different from what we find in the rest of the ancient Near East, even though they have this superficially similar sacrificial system. Okay, so one God, one people, one covenant, one sanctuary. Okay, those are the four elements that Deuteronomy draws out to help revolutionize Israel in the ancient world. Now, one more thing on the structure of Deuteronomy before we move to the PowerPoint on the covenant. Deuteronomy is structured like an ancient treaty. That means it, first of all, introduces the parties, and you'll pick that up in the early chapters of Deuteronomy. Then it talks about some of the historical background, the historical relationship. How have things been going between God and his people? And it rehearses that in Deuteronomy chapters 1 through 4. Then the book introduces the stipulations section. Stipulations is often the longest part of a treaty. The stipulations just talks about what's expected of both sides. What's the fine print in this relationship that's going to exist? And so in treaties, they would talk about things like the king who's the boss king, the big king, expects the lower kings to be faithful, to be loyal, to send armies, troops when he asks for them, to send tribute, of course. And by the way, did I mention tribute? And, you know, these are the things that you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to harbor any refugees, you know, all sorts of stipulations that we find in these treaties. Well, for Israel, the stipulations begin with the 10 words, the Decalogue. And so that lays out the nature of Israel's responsibility. It's a responsibility that involves how they think about God. We talked about commandments 1 through 4 last night. And then how they conduct themselves, commandments 5 through 10. Those sections of how you conduct yourself might seem very vague in general. Don't murder. Okay, good, fine, I'm with that one, but exactly what, where does that cover? We still have those conversations today. Is the Sixth Commandment an argument against capital punishment? Is the Sixth Commandment an argument against warfare? How's the Sixth Commandment work out? Does this mean that what about death in self-defense? I mean, how does it work out? So what we find is that from Deuteronomy 6 through 26, the book is offering an elaboration of the Decalogue. And you can go, they're in order, all the way through the Decalogue, 1 through 10, and it has segments of legal sayings that impact that particular word in the Decalogue. So when you get to the section in Deuteronomy on Commandment 6, the sixth word of the Decalogue, you'll find that there's discussion of capital punishment. And thereby find out that the sixth commandment does not rule out capital punishment. You'll find a whole chapter discussing the conduct of war. And so you find out that the sixth commandment does not mean that there's no room for a just war. Of course, you've still got to figure out what in the world would constitute a just war. Doesn't explain that one for you. But those kinds of issues. So you find out that in that elaboration, you get some of the, I call it sort of a legal portfolio of the different kinds of ideas that come into play in each of the 10 words of the Decalogue. In this way, it gives you a little bit better understanding of what we would call the spirit of the law. And in many senses, it's the same kind of thing that Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount. Remember where he says, you've heard it said you shouldn't kill, but let me tell you something more. And he elaborates, even if you hate your brother, you're running into problems with that commandment. So he goes beyond the letter of the law to let's try to define the territory a little more. And so Deuteronomy is set up in that way from chapters 6 through 26 as an elaboration on the Decalogue so that it can identify some of the ramifications and implications. It's not comprehensive. And that's one of the most important things we're going to learn as we go through today's talks about the nature of the legal sayings that we find. I'm calling them legal sayings, by the way, because I'm trying to stay neutral about calling them actually laws. A legal saying is a little bit more vague than a law, and we'll talk about that as we go on. So, in that sense, that's what we've got in Deuteronomy. Then we move to chapters 27 through 34, and we have some additional information, the closing out of the document, how to handle the document, Moses' last words, and of course, the death of Moses. But the core of the book is in that chapters 6 through 26, as it elaborates the Decalogue. Now again, if we were in a classroom setting and I had a whole semester to unwind this, we'd go through each of those sections and talk about how each section elaborates that particular point in the Decalogue and what that all stands for. We don't have time for that in a one-day seminar. There is a book called Interpreting Deuteronomy that I did an article in, and I went through each of the sections of Deuteronomy and each of the points of the Decalogue and elaborated that. Now that's Interpreting Deuteronomy. It's edited by Philip Johnston and Robeson. Yeah, Robeson and Johnston. So, anyway, let's move to the PowerPoint, see if my computer went to sleep or if we're good. Oh, I think we're good. Okay. I want to talk through the covenant here so that we get an understanding of how it's working. And really what the covenant is. Again, a covenant is an agreement, of course. And it's an agreement that sets up a relationship, formally. Okay, that much is easy to understand, but you still have to ask the question, what is the intention of this agreement? What's the purpose for it? In international relations, the purpose of a treaty is so that it will establish the nature of the relationship between the national entities. And so again, it'll have stipulations that talk about the responsibilities of each side. But why would you make a treaty? Why would you make a covenant? And so when we get to the covenant in the Old Testament, we ask the question, and you can ask it right from the start with Abraham, why would God be making a covenant with people? Whether with Abraham or with the nation of Israel, what's his purpose in doing that? And it's interesting the kinds of answers you might get. One that you hear a lot is, God is making the covenant so that he can make promises and show that he can keep them. I don't buy it. I mean, it's true. If God makes a promise, he'll keep it, and we have that confidence. But to make a covenant agreement just so you can make promises, just so you can keep them, seems a little bit empty. Some would say the covenants are simply a way of administrating the relationship between God and his people. And certainly they do that, but I'm not sure that that's the purpose for them. More often in Christian circles, you'll hear people say that, well, the reason for the covenant is that it's kind of the beginning of God's program for salvation. That God is about bringing salvation. He's going to eventually do that in Jesus. And therefore, the covenant is sort of the beginning of Jesus. It's the Jesus program kicking in. Well, if that's what's going on, I've got a couple questions. Why is it that the covenant doesn't really talk about the possibility of getting salvation for your sins at all until you get to the New Testament? And why is it that the covenant has so many other elements connected to it that don't have anything to do with God's plan of salvation? There's too much going on here that's not answered by that. And through the Old Testament, the Israelites certainly understood the nature of God's covenant with them, and salvation wasn't part of it. Yes, God had saved them from their slavery in Egypt, but that's a lot different from saving people from their sins. And there was no hint given of this saving from sins kind of idea. You know, by the way, that Israel didn't know you could be saved from sins because they had no mechanism for saving them for their sins. Blood of bulls and goats could never take away sin. God didn't tell them that there's some way that eventually even I will provide a way to save you from your sins. He never told them that. We can kind of understand that because it would be kind of a bummer for him to say, you know, someday there's going to be a way for me to save people from our sins. Not you, sorry, you know, you're not in on that plan. You know, someday everybody will have a BMW, but not you, no, no. You know, so that would be kind of, you know, we can understand that God wouldn't do that. But the Israelites didn't know that. Remember that the Israelites did not know that there is any possibility of being with God in eternity forever in heaven. That's never anything God told Israelites about. And after all, how could he tell them about that if the way to get to heaven is through Christ, and Christ had not come, and Christ had not died, and they were still in their sins? How could that possibly be meaningful to them? So Israel, let this sink in, had no hope of heaven. They didn't even know about that possibility. They had no hope of heaven. All they had from God was the offer of relationship here, now, in this world. Relationship was what defined their hope. God's presence among them, not being with God for eternity later. And this makes the temple so important to them, because this is all they have. The relationship with God here is embodied in his presence in the temple. So the covenant was very important because, see, the end result of the covenant was God dwelling in the midst of his people. When God set up the covenant with Abraham, that's where it moves inexorably from Genesis 12, setting up of the covenant, to Exodus chapter 40, God comes and dwells in the tabernacle. That's where it's going. So the covenant concept is tied into relationship. Relationship, not just in formal ways, let's make a treaty, let's make a covenant, so we'll kind of have this agreement. But relationship in terms of God dwelling in the midst of his people. Now, a relationship can't just happen by proximity. That is, just because God happens to be there. We probably all know situations where the parents and the teenagers live in the same house. Proximity exists. Relationship, not so much. It can happen that way. So how does relationship actually happen? Proximity is important, but proximity doesn't do it automatically. What you need is a desire to know one another and the ability to know one another. Now remember, God had come to Israel, to Abraham and to Israel, but he had come to them kind of out of the blue. This is not the kind of God they were used to. This is not the kind of thinking they were used to. This was blowing their minds with the concept of it all and very difficult to grasp what this was all about. But that was because they had innately a wrong, badly wrong understanding of God. Because they only thought of the gods who had needs and the gods who were tyrants and the gods, you know, the pagan view that was out there. That's all they knew of how to think about God. Now, if God was truly going to be in relationship with them, he had to give them a renewed, a revised, a revolutionized view of himself. If this relationship was going to happen, it was going to require a lot of information about how to think differently about God. And of course, we call that revelation. The covenant, then, entails a program of revelation. And that revelation would lead to the understanding necessary so that there could be relationship. God does not reveal himself just to save us. The covenant is not just to get to salvation. Remember that salvation itself is not the end result or the end goal. Salvation is simply what God provides so that fuller, indeed perfect relationship is possible. If we only take our salvation and run and live our own lives and not bother about God, we've missed the point entirely. Salvation is for the purpose of relationship. Covenant is for the purpose of relationship. Revelation is for the purpose of relationship. And as we learned 2 weeks ago, God's whole plan from the start in creating the cosmos, in ordering it as his home for people, was so that we could be in relationship. And when we make our Christianity a matter of legislation, rules that I'm supposed to keep, or make it a matter of benefits that I get to enjoy, and in the process ignore the relationship aspect entirely, we've missed the boat. But I'm getting ahead of myself. That's into my grand finale later on this afternoon. Okay. So let's get back to the thing here. So the people of God and the covenant. Israel, of course, is chosen, elect as the people of God, and God makes a covenant with them. Now, the purpose of that covenant is so that he can reveal himself. It was a blessing that God revealed himself. After all, God didn't have to. The gods in the ancient world didn't. But it was a blessing that God revealed himself through Abraham and his family. All of God's special revelation has taken place through Abraham and his family. They were to be a channel of revelation. And through them would come the incarnation. And through that would come the crucifixion and resurrection and forgiveness of sins. But all of it starts with revelation. And so again, the covenant has this aspect of revelation to it. Now let's track it a little bit. So we have the covenant promises, land, nation, and blessing. Okay? God was going to give Abraham and his family a land. That's a benefit that they would have. He's going to make them a nation. That's a benefit that they would have. He's going to make them a blessing. That's a benefit for all of us. We don't all benefit from the land. We don't all benefit from the nation. We all benefit from the blessing because, in a sense, because God was choosing Abraham as this channel, Abraham and his family, he says, you have something to gain from it. You'll get a land. You'll become a nation because that's how all of this is going to work. He said, but that's not the reason for it. I'm not doing this covenant just to give you land or just to make you a nation. Those are benefits that I'm going to give you because I'm using you for my program and purpose, and I'm going to use the land and the nation as part of that, and those will be benefits that you have. Of course, if you don't cooperate, you can lose them. You can lose the land. You can lose your national status, okay? So there are benefits, but there's a purpose, and the purpose is blessing. And whether you cooperate or not, that is going to happen. See, that's the unconditional part. Conditional are the benefits, land and nation. Unconditional, blessing. God is going to reveal himself through Abraham and his family, whether they cooperate or not, whether they like it or not, whether they're with the program or not. God is going to reveal himself through them. He did. And that's what that's about. This is why he's making the covenant. So, in the patriarchal period, Abraham, we get land, nation, blessing. The charter is laid. And it's set. Now, how does that progress? Okay, we get a transition after the patriarchs. Remember that in the time of Joseph, they go down into Egypt. And they're in Egypt for four centuries or so. So that's a transition. What's happening during those four centuries? Well, they're becoming a nation. Now, it's a little bit uncomfortable because they're becoming a nation, but they're becoming a nation of slaves. That's not the way it's supposed to work. They're not in their land. They're in somebody else's land, and that's not how it's supposed to work. They are being a blessing, but in all the wrong ways. That is, they are blessing the Egyptians with all of their free labor, but that's not how it's supposed to work. So things are kind of in development in this first transition, and that leads us into the next stage where Moses comes along. And so here we find the Mosaic covenant. This is what takes place in Deuteronomy. Here's the Deuteronomy stage. Okay, so we have, with each of these phases of the covenant, we have some new aspects. We have a new aspect of election and a new aspect of revelation with each phase of the covenant. Okay, so the first phase that we see of the covenant after that first transitionary period is the Mosaic section, new election. Here the election is Israel as a nation, as God's people. You know, God had never said that to Abraham. God had chosen him and his family and those kinds of things, but it never said, and I'm going to take that nation as my special people. Never said that, but it comes along in Exodus chapter 19. And so we have this election of Israel as the people of God. And then we have this revelation, the revelation of God's character. How does that take place? The law. We'll talk about that more in the next segment. So new revelation, the law, God's character, and new election, Israel as the people of God. Now, there's a second transition. That second transition is the judges period. When things go really badly wrong, Israel is unfaithful over and over and over again. God sells them into the hands of their enemies, and so they are under foreign rule over and over again. And we work through that transition where they're really not living up to their election as God's people, and they're really not honoring the character of God that was given to them in the law. But finally, that transition reaches an end. Again, that's about four centuries. We have these four-century transitions. And it brings us to the monarchy, where we get a new phase of the covenant. This is the, This is the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel chapter 7. And in the Davidic covenant, we have a new point of election, David as the chosen king. God had told Abram and even Jacob that kings will come from your line. But no more about it. No more about a particular king and a particular royal line, all of that. That's new in the Davidic covenant. So we have David as the chosen king. That's the new election. And new revelation, the idea that kingship is going to be a way that God reveals his sovereignty. Now, the way that was supposed to work was the idea that the king should reflect the kind of king that God is. That's why Saul didn't work. I mean, Saul was the people's choice for a king. He was not God's choice for a king. And so when the people choose Saul, they're going all the wrong direction. Saul was not a representation of God's kingship. David comes along, and the story of David and Goliath is extremely important here. Now remember that Saul had been chosen to lead forth the armies in battle. Here's a battle. There's Goliath saying, send out your champion. And Saul is in the tent taking volunteers. Say, this is not how it was supposed to be. Saul's the guy that's supposed to be out there fighting in the power of the Lord. So David comes along, shepherd boy, comes into the camp. He says, who's that big guy in the valley? What's going on here? He's defying the Lord. Are we going to put up with that? And so he's told the situation. And David says, okay, help me out here. I don't understand. He's defying God, okay, by the Philistine gods. Now, is our God stronger than the Philistine gods? You know, who could disagree? Sure, yes, of course he is. Okay, and who is it that fights the battles? Is it the human armies and the human warriors, or is it God? Well, it's God. Okay, so if he's defying our God, and therefore we have a situation to deal with, and God's the one who fights the battle, and our God is stronger, then, tell me if I'm wrong, it doesn't matter who goes out there. Anybody could go out there. I could go out there. Wouldn't make any difference. Our God's stronger. Our God's fighting the battles. It's not how big that guy is. It's not how experienced he is. Anybody could go out there. I'd go. You see, David had the right idea about God's kingship. And that's what that story shows. This is not about who are the giants in your life or what are the five stones in your bag. This is about God's kingship. And David shows himself to be God's kind of king because he understands that God fights the battles while Saul's in their tent taking volunteers. Kingship was designed to show God's sovereignty. Now, it rarely stood up to that. You know, David had lots of problems, no question about it. Remember, heroes of the Bible, there's only one. His name is God. And so we don't go that direction of saying, oh, David is just, you know, put him up on a pedestal. No. But he had this one thing right. He had this one thing right. God's the one who fights the battles. So then we get to a third transition. Third transition, we call it the exile and then the post-exilic period. They've lost their king. Right? There's no king now after the destruction by Babylon in the 6th century. And so we get this third transition, which takes us eventually to Christ. And now we have the phase that we refer to as the New Covenant. New Covenant is another phase of the Abrahamic Covenant. It has some new features to it, of course. Here a new point of election, believers as the people of God. Nothing anticipated that in the earlier sections. This is a new point of election that was unanticipated, and a new point of revelation. Revelation now, salvation as God's provision. So we have God's character revealed through the law, we have God's kingship revealed through the kings, we have God's salvation revealed through Christ in the new covenant. In all of these, God is revealing himself to the people, various aspects of who he is and what he's done, and again, there are stages of election that are taking place. So we track it right through history and through these phases of the covenant. But this is all part of the covenant promises that were given right in the beginning. Now, as we close this session, I want you to notice a couple things here, a couple more comments that I need to make. First of all, across the top, I just changed that. Notice the change that takes place. When we identify Israel as the people of God, I would call them the revelatory people of God. I know that's kind of a weird phrase. But what I mean is, we shouldn't think about Israel as being saved. When we call Israel the people of God, it doesn't mean that they're saved. We know that Israel made lots of mistakes. We know that there were unfaithful Israelites and there were faithful Israelites, but they were all part of the people of God. Ethnically, they were part of the people of God. And it didn't have to do with whether they were in right relationship with God or not, or whether they're on their way to heaven. Of course, they aren't. Jesus hasn't come. Okay, so they are the people of God in the sense that God chose them as his people for a particular role, to reveal him. So they are the revelatory people of God. They are revealing the nature of God. That's what they're chosen for. That is their status as God's people. Now, there comes a point where that shifts, where the people of God takes on a new definition. And that's in the red here. It takes on a new definition because now that revelation process has culminated in sending Christ and him dying. Now we have a means of salvation available, and the people of God now is soteriological. That just means salvation, okay? So they are the people who are saved, who choose the mechanism that Christ has provided. And so they are the people of God in that they have gotten into that program. Now, of course, Israel, as the revelatory people of God, could have transitioned in easily enough. They should have been first in line. That's exactly what Romans tells us. What advantage then has the Jew? Paul asks us. Every advantage in every way. They had the oracles of God. God had revealed himself to them, and they should have just been ready to step right into that. But it didn't happen that way. And so Paul becomes the apostle to the Gentiles. So this idea that as God's revelatory people, they could have easily transitioned, and some did, into the saved ones, the ones that have accepted the mechanism that God provided and become his people in a new way. It's not that Israel got fired or dismissed from being the people of God. They were chosen to be the people of God in order to be an instrument of revelation. They did that. That happened. They were that instrument. And that program ended because Christ came. Christ, the climax and culmination of God's revelatory program. Their job was done. Now it was time to transition into a different kind of people of God, and many of them didn't take it. Finally, I need to close this off here. Notice on each of the squares here, Jesus reveals God's character because he is God. He is the Son of God, and he lives out God's character on earth. Jesus is the Messiah. He is God's king, and he shows God's kingship and his sovereignty. And Jesus is the Savior. That is, he is the provision of God for salvation. In that way, when we ask the question, how did Jesus fulfill the covenant? He fulfilled the covenant because each phase of the covenant was lived out in Jesus, and really we see three of his primary names, Son of God, Messiah, Savior, that relate to the three basic phases of the covenant. And so Jesus is the fulfillment of the covenant. We need to stop there, and I think I went a little bit over time, but now it's time for a break. Is that correct? Food? Yeah, okay. I see food back on the table. We'll continue at 11 o'clock.